Support for this podcast comes from Washington Wise, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington affect your portfolio and your money every day. But what policy changes should investors be watching? Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab. The show unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and investments. Listen today at schwab.com/washingtonwise. That's schwab.com/washingtonwise.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
It's The Weeds. I'm Jonquilin Hill. I don't know about you, but I'm having some vibe-session fatigue. Don't get me wrong. It's important to talk about the economy, but story after story about how the economy is good, but people don't feel like it. And I start to get antsy. We know things don't feel good, but how did we get here in the first place? And how do we make it stop? So today, instead of talking about the way things are, we're going to talk about how things could be. Essentially, we're going to write some economic fan fiction. Because the 2024 election, unfortunately, like a lot of elections, isn't really going to be about policy.
Howdy, JQ. It's nice to meet you.
Howdy. It's nice to meet you, too. That's Catherine Ann Edwards. She's an economist, writes a column for Bloomberg, and does some independent research and policy consulting. She's also on TikTok, where she wields a very tiny microphone to talk about some very big economic ideas. Catherine told me the weird feelings people have right now aren't so much about the economy itself. It's actually more about policy failures.
The only conclusion possible from the economy doing well but people not feeling well is that the prosperity and success of the economy is not getting to all the people in it. There is some reason why, no matter how rich the country is getting, some people feel left behind or some people feel like they're still struggling. That's about basically the fruits of labor not, you know, coming in. There's lots of things that influence people's opinion that aren't necessarily related to economic performance that can color their view of the world. But the commonality of frustrations point to public policy failures, right? It's not a perception that housing is really hard to afford right now. It is not a perception that food has increased 25% in prices over the past 3 years. Those aren't perceptions. Those are experiences. And that's not really up for interpretation.
What are some of the policy failures that you know that sort of are at the root of this problem?
How long do we have? Prepare for your 15-hour episode. there's a lot. And I think it's worth noting that it is somewhat of a subjective assessment to say this is a policy failure, because my policy failure might not be a failure to somebody else, someone who has a different bent or a different point of view. There's no one definition. There's one definition of what is the economy. There's no one definition of what's wrong with it. So leaving that on the table, I mean, you can take, for example, childcare. Prices for childcare ages 0 to 5 in the United States over the past 30 years have risen faster than food, housing, energy, medical care, and even the poster child of prices being too high, prescription drugs, right? Your childcare has risen faster than prescription drugs. The only assessment you can make is that it is undersupplied and overdemanded. At the same time, it is a vastly important part of our economy to invest in the youth. So this, to me, is a clear market failure. The private market cannot supply childcare adequately, sufficiently, or in high enough quality. Therefore, it needs to be a source of public investment. That was probably true 45 years ago. It's still true today. There's been no movement.
So you argue there are all these policy failures that undercut the economic growth we've had, And I want to narrow the conversation a little bit more. If you had to really dig into one area where we're not doing what we need to do, what would it be?
I'd start with retirement. I know, why start at the end? why start at the end for the thing that's like not even binding in the majority of people's life right now? Well, one is the share of Americans who are not retired, who feel like they are, you know, well prepared for retirement is falling. It's around 30% now. And even for people in their 60s, it's only about 40. So the majority of Americans do not feel like they are on track for the biggest investment that they will ever make that will determine a massive part of their life. Two, retirement is really fascinating to me because it is the report card. When you think of any measure of inequality or economic hardship, they're always point in time. What do you earn right now? What do you own right now? What are you paying right now for heat, for housing, for rent? That won't be 40 years of your life. Most people will move around. They'll have good years. They'll have bad years. They'll move up and down. What's hard right now might not be hard for you in 1 year or five. But retirement, it's like the report card. It is the cumulative experience that you have had in the economy throughout your adult working life. And there's no avoiding the failures. There's no outgrowing them. It is just not how you did on like one quiz or one test or how many times you relate to class. It is the comprehensive grade of how well you did. And we are failing.
So retirement security is sort of this report card for us. Define what retirement security is. What are we talking about when we talk about how Americans save for retirement?
So retirement security would be that you are in a financial position that you can afford stability and quality of life when you stop working. That's a pretty loaded kind of definition because financial...
That's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot, right? So financial position would be you've saved enough, invested enough, own enough that you have enough wealth and savings to stop working. And that savings and wealth is such that you can have stable income for the rest of your life and that income is high enough to meet your quality of life, knowing that all three of those benchmarks, how much you need to save, how much you need to have an income, and what your quality of life is different for every American.
So how do Americans currently save for retirement?
Okay, a lot of them don't.
Well, yeah, that'll do it. Yep, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
So hitting the first problem, a lot of them don't. So the structure of retirement savings right now comes through your employer in that you start working for someone and your employer opens a retirement account on your behalf, a 401k, or if you work for a nonprofit, it could be a 403b. And they open up that retirement account and you are allowed to contribute to it. It's possible that they could contribute to it up to an amount and that together you will save for retirement through this employer-sponsored account. The government sweetens the deal by having those savings be tax preferred, meaning that neither you nor your employer pay income or payroll taxes on the money that you put into this retirement account. You're taxed later when you take it out. So there's a massive tax incentive. Your employer sets it up. You contribute. And as long as you continually contribute and put in enough and don't touch it, you'll have money for when you retire. Well, so why isn't that working?
Why isn't that working?
It all sounds great in theory. It has several problems. Half of Americans don't have access to a retirement account at their current job. They don't have it in about half of jobs, and that covers about half of people. Another big problem is that people dip into their retirement savings account before they retire. And so even if they have an employer account, they go through something terrible, right? Like a health shock, job loss, they get divorced, they end up, you know, kind of dipping into their retirement savings. And then the subsidy for it to sweeten the deal, it's highly, highly unequal. The bottom 40% of Americans benefit from 5% of the total tax expenditure that goes to subsidies for retirement savings through these accounts. Mm. So let's say I put the middle class in there too. And in the bottom 60% of Americans, they get less than 15%. This is a massive amount of tax subsidy. It comes up to over 1% of our total economy size and GDP, and more than half of it goes to the top 20% of households. So we are spending a fortune in our tax dollars to subsidize the retirement savings of the wealthy and the rich. And the bottom half of Americans basically don't have any retirement savings.
Catherine has big ideas to fix the way we save for retirement. After the break, her Roman Empire.
Social Security is my Roman Empire. The number of Thanksgivings I have spent talking about Social Security to family members, the number of times I've had to just like answer cold, like in a bar, someone comes up and is like, oh, Social Security is a Ponzi scheme. Convince me otherwise. And I'm like, it's nice to meet you, guy.
Support for The Weeds comes from Not Another Politics Podcast from the Harris School of Public Policy. With the constant news cycle, there's a lot of noise out there. Opinions are plastered all over social media. Pundits are throwing out hot takes without any sort of context. And it's only getting worse as we dive farther into election season. We know that if you're listening to us at The Weeds, you're looking to cut through all this. And if you like this show, you might like Not Another Politics Podcast. Not Another Politics Podcast is produced by the University of Chicago Harris School of Public Policy. They want to take a research and data approach to analyzing hot button issues and offer perspectives that go beyond the headlines. They cover a wide variety of topics in their episodes, but a few recent episodes that you can listen to include a deep dive into why women are underrepresented in U.S. politics or whether or not we can believe political surveys. You can listen and subscribe today at harris.uchicago.edu/NAPP. That's N-A-P-P. Support for The Weeds comes from Mint Mobile. Some might say that sauce is what makes us a proper society. Like, imagine a world without hot sauce, or barbecue sauce, or Worcestershire sauce, or however it's pronounced. It's inconceivable. Well, Mint Mobile agrees, and their secret sauce is that they sell their wireless service totally online. They don't worry at all about retail costs, and they say that lets them pass those savings on to you. It's why their premium wireless plans start at just $15 a month. With Mint Mobile, you could say goodbye to an overpriced monthly phone bill or unexpected fees. All of their plans come with unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. Signing up is super easy, and you could even bring your own phone and phone number with you to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/weeds. That's mintmobile.com/weeds. You could cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/weeds. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.
We're back. It's The Weeds. I'm Jonquilin Hill. We're talking with economist Catherine Edwards about the economic policies that could be. In particular, we're digging into retirement. But before we explore more of her ideas, I asked her to lay out the history of a major part of a lot of Americans' retirement, Social Security.
Social Security is a very old program. It started in 1935, and it is a social insurance program. So it's not a retirement savings account. It is not a retirement investment account. It is an insurance benefit. You contribute over your lifetime in your payroll taxes to earn coverage in case an insured event occurs. In this case, the insured event for you and your family is that you grow old, you grow disabled, or you die. And the coverage that you get in exchange is a guaranteed minimum standard of living and economic security for your lifetime. Basically, what that means is in exchange of paying taxes into Social Security, you will have an inflation-adjusted income for the rest of your life. So no matter what happens, Should private savings fail you on any level that you couldn't save in a retirement account, a non-retirement account, you just didn't have enough money, no matter what happens, you have the guarantee from Social Security that you will have income for the rest of your life and it will never decline in real terms. And that's what you buy through your tax contributions is the guarantee, not the return, the guarantee.
What are some of the misconceptions that we have about Social Security and how it works?
Probably the biggest misconception in that it's the farthest off and most commonly held is that Social Security is running out of money, which is something that people say like, oh yeah, it's running out of money. And young people, they're like, well, it won't be there for me. It's running out of money. That's wildly inaccurate because it can't run out of money. So when you think run out of money, you think like, oh, like we're going to get to a point where like one guy retires and Social Security is like, sorry, y'all got to board up.
Like that's it. Sorry, he got the last check.
Whenever I use this, I always call him Jim. Like, Jim got it. Sorry, y'all. He got the last check, and that's all the checks we got, and Social Security is no more. No, it doesn't work like that at all. Social Security's basically income comes from the payroll taxes that all workers pay. So as long as there is a worker in the economy, and there should be, you know, about 170 million of us. As long as there is a worker in the economy, Social Security has income. The question is, do they have enough income to meet the benefits they promised? They do right now. They have for the vast majority of existence. It's projected that they won't. And if it comes to the point where they do have a shortfall, which will happen probably in 10 years, they just cut all benefits by the amount of the shortfall, and then they go on paying benefits forever. So it can't go bankrupt. It can't run out of money. The biggest misconception that people have is that they won't get Social Security when, in fact, the only way you will not get Social Security is if Congress votes to take it away from you. That is the only way you could not have a Social Security check in old age.
I don't know if it's an irony, but this idea, you know, Social Security is a pay-as-you-go program. So, you know, they're taking it out of my check, and that is paying for, like, people my parents' age's retirement. But I just think of like the lack of babies we're having because we can't, say, afford childcare. And then in turn, when we are our parents' age, there will be far fewer people paying into Social Security for us.
The demographics, right? You're like, you're thinking of like person in, person out. And it kind of sets up this like, oh yeah, Social Security is basically built on the idea that the population will always be growing. And so you could always take care of old people. And the challenge now is that we have too many old people and not enough young people. What Social Security is actually predicated on is that earnings will always grow. So that the people who are working today are always earning so much more than the people who are retiring so that they can more than clear the benefits that they are funding. And actually, that is the biggest threat to Social Security. And what probably people understand or get wrong is that they think that it's just about the number of babies or the number of old people. It's truly just about earnings. And that is a long-term problem that the program is having a very hard time handling, that the amount of taxes being paid in are threatened less by the number of people and more that so many people have had frozen and stagnated wages.
Yeah, I want to get into that wage stagnation piece and also the fact that, you know, there's a maximum amount of income that you can tax for Social Security. So I just want to talk about how that factors into all of this.
The idea of Social Security is that it's an insurance program. So it's meant to protect against the risk of economic insecurity in old age. So at some point, if you're rich enough, that risk is pretty low. So the idea of Social Security was that we'd only need to tax up to a certain amount of wages, because if this is an insurance program that handles risk, you know, the risk is small enough, then we don't need to collect more. So in 1983, they set the cap at 90% of wages, where if you took every single person in the U.S. who had a paycheck, summed all of their paychecks together into one big number, you would basically go up to the top 90% and then stop. And 90% of all earnings in the U.S. are going to be taxed. That number has dropped. It is eroded down to 82, because what's happening is that they set the cap and they increase it every year based on the average. But people who earn above the cap, their wages are rising so much faster than people who earn below the cap that the amount of wages that Social Security is taxing is falling every year in shares because people above the cap have seen their income rise. So this is hard. This is nuanced. Like, it's very hard to think about. But like in 1983, say like 90% of earnings covered $90,000. So the top 10% of earnings was $100,000. And so Social Security is going to tax $90,000 down. And now every year, however much the average wage grows is how much that $90,000 cutoff. So it goes up to like $90,500 and then like maybe $91,200. And every year, based on the change in average wages, the cutoff goes up. And the cutoff goes up by the average each year. But people who earned $80,000 saw their income grow below the average. And people who earned $100,000 saw their income grow at like twice the average. So even as the average was pulling up the cutoff, the wages were growing so fast at the top that the share itself was eroding. And so that's why this major threat to Social Security's financial stability is that it is not taxing as much as it used to. I mean, the short version of it is Social Security is absolutely prepared for changes in demographics. It is not prepared for crippling wage inequality.
How do we reform Social Security?
We reform Social Security by basically passing a series of small changes to the taxes and benefits so that the 75-year window is met. Reforming Social Security, fixing the shortfall, is actually very doable. The Office of the Actuary of Social Security publishes 140 different ways you can do it and exactly how well they'll work. So it's really just going to the shopping cart and picking out what we want to do. I think the question in some sense is like, how do we improve Social Security? How do we modernize it? How do we update it so it meets kind of like the vast preferences that Americans have in 2024 that might be different than the questions that Americans had in 1980? But reforming Social Security, it's really just a math problem and probably a smaller math problem than people realize.
What are the sticking points that prevent bipartisan support for Social Security reform? Where's the disagreement happening?
It's whether or not you cut benefits or raise taxes. Democrats don't want to cut benefits. Republicans don't want to raise taxes. And then the wonks like me are like, but we could even make it better if we did something besides those two things.
Or like, what about a secret
third
thing?
What about a secret third thing when we like do a lot of cool shit to Social Security to make it a better program? Like we have like a flexible retirement age. We allow people to claim partial benefits. We add paid family leave to it. Like, I mean, we're like, our secret third thing is like the quiet part out loud of like, let's make this program awesome. You know, I will say that in 15 years of talking about Social Security pretty regularly, of having a 15-year Roman Empire of Social Security in my head, the most popular policy always is raise the cap or get rid of the cap. And I've never talked about Social Security in conversation where someone didn't say with a certain amount of anger, like, get rid of the cap. But I think for a lot of Republicans, they would view that as a non-starter, even though there's no cap on Medicare taxes. Mm. They got rid of that in the 90s. And you know what? They were fine. The cap went up to all earnings for Medicare and like people were okay. The other problem I will say is that Democrats have this amazing ability to talk themselves into a corner. And so one thing that many Democrats, including Joe Biden, have said is that they will not raise taxes on people making less than $400,000. Well, the tax cap's at around $160,000. So if you want to get rid of the cap, right, you've got to raise taxes on people from $160,000 and up. So now there are these like truly awful proposals for donut tax coverage where you don't reinstate the payroll tax until you get to $400,000 and then raise it. So you have like a gap of like $200,000 worth of earnings that don't get taxed and then it comes back on again. So like no one's winning awards here. Like, let's not pretend like there's just like one set of great ideas that's coming from one direction and that no bad idea has ever emerged. I mean, the donut has got to be any type of donut is just like, oh, God, y'all, please don't do this.
And when we do, we see the donut hole has a hole in its center. It is not a donut hole, but a smaller donut with its own hole.
So that's Social Security in its current iteration. Up next, we talk about what it would mean if we saved for retirement differently.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brené Brown, and this is Unlocking Us. In this podcast, we'll explore ideas, stories, experiences, research, books, films, music, anything that reflects the universal experiences of being human, from the bravest moments to our most brokenhearted moments. Some episodes will be conversations with the people who are teaching me, challenging me, confusing me, maybe ticking me off a little bit. And some days I'll just talk directly to you about what I'm learning and how it's changing the way I think and feel. The first episodes are out now. We're going to do 3 or 4 part series every quarter, so about 12 to 15 episodes a year. Unlocking Us will always drop on Wednesdays. And now you can find me wherever you normally listen to your podcasts. You can get new episodes as soon as they are published by following Unlocking Us on your favorite podcast app. And as always, stay awkward, brave, and kind.
Once upon a time in America, there was no such thing as all-you-can-eat shrimp. And then the world changed.
Today, shrimp is the most popular, the most consumed seafood in America. The endless shrimp fiesta is an American institution.
But that shrimp fiesta comes at a steep price. Here at Gastropod, we found out that hidden behind the delicious shrimp on your plate is environmental disaster and modern-day slavery.
So can you have your shrimp and a clear conscience too? Actually, yes, and we've got the secret to help you unlock true, lifelong shrimp happiness. Listen to the latest episode of Gastropod wherever you get your podcasts.
So I want to start kind of fully authoring our fan fiction. You know, let's log into the economic version of Archive of Our Own and get to writing. So the goal that you have stated is by 2044, everyone has enough to retire. I'm curious how we get there, especially if things stay the way they are right now. You know, the way we're on track right now, only 80% of Social Security's obligations will be covered by 2035. How do we get to everyone having enough for retirement by 2044?
Well, the easy answer is they save more.
Yes.
The hard part is addressing why the majority of Americans are not able to save enough, and in somewhere in the middle, fixing Social Security. So what I like about this problem from a fan fiction perspective, I don't actually like that it's so hard to save for retirement in our economy, but from a fan fiction of like writing out our econ fan fiction, what I like about it is that it is a very classic liberal versus conservative debate. Mm-hmm. So on the left, what do we do in response to a problem? The government needs to do more. That is the answer. If we need to save more, the government needs to do more. And I think their argument would follow the logic that what I brought up earlier, we're currently spending over 1% of GDP to subsidize retirement savings for the richest Americans. That's not efficient, it's not effective, and it's leaving people behind. What we need to do is make sure that everybody has access to the kind of employer type retirement account with the tax preference. And we shouldn't kind of concentrate our tax expenditure to the top. We need to make sure everyone gets it. The government needs to restructure our current tax incentive system and restructure our current account system so everyone can benefit. It's about the government doing more. Well, on the right, it's about the government doing less. On their end, they're like, look, Social Security is an amazing program, but it's not 1935 anymore. And we do not need as much shepherding from the government for our retirement security. It's not efficient or effective to put so much money into Social Security when the alternative is money that could be going into a private market that will yield much higher dividends over a long term. It's about getting people access to that money and those accounts so that they can take advantage of the market. The government needs to do less. What I love about this is that they actually both end up in the same place, mm-hmm. which is that the answer to retirement insecurity and how in 2044 everyone has retirement savings is that every American has a government-funded retirement savings account that they can exercise control over.
Okay. So I take my 401k and instead of that, I use this government, you know, backed, funded type of situation.
Well,
or in addition, or instead of.
So this is the debate, right? This is the fan fiction. Like, it's not a mystery how to get people to save more. You give them a retirement account. You help contribute to it. They augment that savings. It lasts for their lifetime and accrues in values mainly through time, but also stock market returns. That's not the hard part. The hard part is in the fictional debate is, how do we get there? Do we chip away at employer-sponsored plans, or do we chip away at Social Security? So somewhere in there, there is a drastic change to the current structuring of retirement security through the subsidies that we give to 401ks or the taxes and spending we give through Social Security. If you're on the left, everyone gets a government 401k and they match 5% of your earnings, and we don't do tax expenditures for employer accounts anymore. If your employer wants to set one up, they're free to do so, but we're not going to put government money into it anymore through the tax system. On the right, you know, this is convert Social Security to individual accounts. Like, this is my money and my tax contribution. It's time for me to have control over such long investment. The middle would probably be some hybrid version of the three, where you have a government account, an employer account, still some type of tax subsidy, and Social Security is fixed, whether it's expanded or amended, we can't see. But I call it fan fiction because I wish this is what we were debating right now. I mean, I can tell you all of these policies. I can tell you anything you wanted to know about Social Security, and then a lot more. And I could tell you various ways that we can set up individual retirement accounts that has some type of government backing. The fictional part comes from Americans debating which one they want.
It would be great to have these conversations versus, I don't know, watching the horse race and who did what gaffe and let's watch the polling, blah, 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 and actually solve some problems. Like, that would, I admit, that would be very cool.
You know, I mean, I saw the first like AI generated fake ad and I was like, oh God. I don't think we're going to fix Social Security come November. I just have this feeling that it's not going to hit to the front. But I think this is a question for Americans about the direction we want to go in, right? Do we want to cannibalize the current employer-sponsored system, or do we want to cannibalize the current government insurance system? Because otherwise, we're trying to do all three, and that will be harder to afford and harder to do as well. So that's really the question of, where does the money for these individual accounts come from, and what does the rest of the government and private retirement portfolio look like? But I take a lot of hope in knowing that, like, in some ways, the answer is pretty easy. Like, we all just need accounts.
Would making a government retirement account, would that make saving for retirement universal?
Basically. So there are a lot of bipartisan proposals to do this, and there are a couple in Congress, and it would model this individual account after the thrift savings plan. So if you have any federal employees or service members amongst your listeners, they could tell you that the thrift savings plan is a benefit they get as an employee, and it is basically a government 401k. With the exception that it is managed funds. So when the government contributes to a thrift saving plan for its employees, they default into a managed investment fund based on the employee's age. And then if the employee wants to take over the investment, they can. They basically manage the plans at a very, very low cost to kind of meet people's age necessity as they retire. So more risk when you're young, less risk as you're older. Employees have to do nothing. And through the federal government and all of its employees, it's been found that this is a highly successful savings plan. So not only do we know that people need individual accounts that the government sponsors, we have a very good road-tested model about how to do it. It's to mimic the thrift savings plan. There's a proposal in Congress to do just that. The question is, does everyone get it, or do you get it only if you don't have an employer-sponsored account? Meaning, is the plan universal, or is the plan kind of like a wraparound for the people who don't have employer accounts? That is the real debate about that one. But again, the answer and the implementation are so much easier than the path, which has its own advantages in our world of fan fiction.
I kind of want to dig into the conservative argument, which is, you know, don't tax this, let people invest it on their own. They know what they're doing. And not to sound paternalistic, but would people actually save for retirement if they had that money back in their pocket? I mean, earlier we talked about the cost of childcare, stagnant wages, all of these things. Would people actually save for retirement on their own if given the opportunity?
No and yes. The need for retirement savings and the want to save extends up and down the income and wage distribution. Like, everybody wants to save more. It's not as if people don't save because they don't think it's important. They don't save because they have barriers to saving. If you were to have a lower Social Security tax bill and that's it, we probably wouldn't see that much more in savings. I mean, maybe a small amount, but not a massive amount. You know, the conservative proposal would be to take the tax contributions that you make from Social Security and put it into an individual account instead of a PAYGO retirement system. And so there's still savings because they're forced to via the payroll tax, but their savings going into an account that they control. It's a really attractive plan, especially when you think of the type of returns that people can get over the stock market from 40 years. I mean, can you imagine if every American had contributed 4% of their income to like an index fund, starting with like the first horrible job they got at 16. I mean,
oh my God,
right? Like, just like so much money. Like, that is the argument of like, we are just leaving millions on the table for Americans by taking all this money and putting it into Social Security. And I think that argument is really attractive and that if people should have that. The counter argument is Social Security isn't meant to provide wealth. It's meant to reduce risk. And there is still so much risk inherent in any form of private savings that you're basically stripping away the insurance and leaving all the risk. Risk that comes from what happened to a lot of people in the Great Recession. The stock market took a turn right as they were about to retire. I mean, when the financial crisis happened, it erased trillions of dollars of retirement savings that were invested in the market. I mean, do you know when a financial bubble is about to burst so you'll know to move your money out of the stock market before that happens and you're not left holding the bag? Or, you know, the vast majority of people's retirement savings is their home. Like, did you know when a hurricane was going to hit your house? Did you know when you were going to be flooded or when your home caught on fire or there was an earthquake and you lost everything? Or maybe there was just a housing bubble and your home is worth $400,000 less than you thought it was? I mean, these risks don't go away. You can give people more money, but the risks don't go away. And they, you know, on some level, they just get scarier because we don't know what they're going to be in 2060. And the counterweight to you could be making a lot more money is you could be losing a lot more money. And now you're losing 4% of all Americans' earned income. And they'll, if they don't have it, they're going to return to the government anyway and say, we need help. Because if you bail out banks and if you bail out funds, you have to bail out Americans who lost their retirement savings. And so some ways this is just like, look, like, I know you think you can beat every risk, but at the end of the day, if you didn't, we'd still have to pay. So we might as well set up our payment ahead of time, like from the government's perspective.
Do we have any idea what Americans prefer? Has there been, you know, extensive polling on this at all?
Americans love Social Security. They don't think they're going to get it, but they tend to really love Social Security. They love that like their grandparents and their parents have Social Security, that they can see their parents and grandparents have independent living into old age. And if they're retired, they love it, with the exception of a lot of pretty wealthy people who don't like it and don't know why they get it and will tell you they don't need it. Or that like, well, I give my Social Security check to charity every year. I don't need anything from it. And there's almost like a pride of place there. So it is a little like a split personality, but the split is much higher of like people love it and need it and want to make sure it's there, and lower on the like, this program is beneath me. I mean, when people tell you they won't need Social Security, I'm always like,
that's so bold.
I admire your confidence, brah. Like, where does this come from? Like, how do you know?
I want that kind of confidence. Not maybe necessarily regarding Social Security, but just in life.
Imagine how great every outfit I would be. The confidence. I mean, it's like, I won't need Social Security is like, I'll never have a messy divorce. I'll never have a health shock for anyone in my family that could be expensive. I'll never lose money on a house. I'll never lose money in investment. I'll never be left holding the bag. I'll definitely never lose my job at the wrong time. Like, I mean, it's just the things that have to go into place for you to just invest and that be the only thing you need to do to be ready for retirement and nothing else threaten it is just such an incredible constellation of events. It's hard to imagine the confidence to say, I will be fine, but it must be nice.
So there's this sense that some American policies are so entrenched that they will never shift. What makes the shift happen? Like, I consider myself an optimist and just, you know, very bright-eyed, but even I struggle to believe that some of these changes can take place.
Well, for one thing, we know exactly when Social Security is going to be fixed. 10 minutes before it passes a 20% benefit cut on every existing and future beneficiary. Congress is, I mean, they like have a flair for deadlines and high stakes drama. Like, there's no way they'll fix it early. It is the most expensive way to fix it is to wait to the last minute. But like, we know when they're going to drive it home, and it is the last hour, I would assume near midnight. So we know Social Security is going to be fixed and that they're not going to do it ahead of time, but they will fix it because no one wants to be the member of Congress that cut elderly benefits by 20%. I mean, estimates are if they do that, I mean, you're looking at like a tripling of elderly poverty at a time period when we'll have 70 million elderly Americans of baby boomers. I mean, no one's going to want to take credit for that. So they will do the right thing and fix Social Security somehow in 2033, you know, December 31st, 11:30 p.m. We're all just waiting for the ball to drop, wondering if the other shoe is going to drop.
Just like, oh.
There's going to be like a ticker. Like, the ball is going to be counting down and there's going to be a live feed of C-SPAN of like, Jesus, are they going to do it? Like, that. There's going to be a New Year's Eve that is so incredibly high stakes for everyone. But they'll fix it. You know, as for, you know, whether or not we'll move to these retirement accounts, whether or not we'll get the system that we know that we need and that we'll get the system that we know will serve every American better, I can understand the pessimism. Surely we all can. But, you know, it's different from not knowing what we need to do is what I'll say, at least in the case of retirement. Like, at least we know what we need to do. And getting it there, we're probably closer on retirement than almost anything else that I was planning on discussing in fan fiction. Because there's even a bipartisan bill right now to start this process. So we are on our way. I think it'll happen slowly. I think it won't get a lot of attention. I think Americans won't get a chance to weigh in because they won't have a chance to do so through their candidates. But I think we will come up with something. The question I always have is it the best solution if it's made for Americans as opposed to by Americans, with them vocalizing, you know, what they want to see?
So I actually am going to turn one of your prompts back to you. What do you want the economy to look like in 25 years? What are its features? What does it have? What do we achieve?
My dream would be, if we're really shooting for the moon, that you get like, you get an economy where the youth of tomorrow are so like disdainful and disgusted by the way things work today, where like, you would just have some kid be like, oh my God, you like didn't have health insurance? That is gross. You know, just this kind of like, what do you mean people paid 50% of their income for rent? That is crazy. Why would you do that? What was wrong with you people? Like, I just want them to have this like uninformed disdain of certain facts for our economy today, because by then those problems are so solved, it seems incredible that someone would ever pay 50% of their income to rent, because housing is so secure by that point that they're like, God, that is dystopian. Y'all lived through some stuff. You know, like I want to feel the future youth's like incredulity through whatever slang is popular then that I don't understand.
Yeah. You know, like that meme where it's just like, I paid more than a third of my income to housing. And it's like, let's get you to bed, grandma.
Like, yeah. I mean, I think it's all possible. I mean, it's not like there's anything about the U.S. economy that is like, oh, sorry, we actually can never have affordable housing. None of that is like, nothing is fated. Nothing is fixed. It's all a policy choice. Unfortunately, every policy choice over the past 25 years has gone towards, let's not do anything. It's not even like we're making terrible choices. We're making no choices. I think we could do a lot. We can change a lot if we want to, which is why that was the ultimate motivation for writing fan fiction, was to communicate through whatever tiny microphone that I have that we're not fated. we can change our economic direction. We can change how the economy is working for people. You feel like there's a vibe session that the economy is fine and you're not. That's not how our economy has to work or even does work. You just make the right policies and that goes away. And I think the duality kind of comes back together when you realize that there are solutions, even if they feel so out of reach, they are fictional.
Catherine Edwards, thank you so much for joining us on The Weeds.
Thank you so much for having me.
Retirement isn't the only policy Catherine envisions differently. If you want to read more of her economic fan fiction, you can check out her Bloomberg column. There's a link in the show notes. And if you have any fanciful ideas, we want to hear about them. Send your comments, questions, and topics you want to hear more about to our email. It's weeds@vox.com. That's all for us today. Thank you to Catherine Edwards for joining me. Our producer is Sophie Lalonde. Christian Ayala engineered this episode. Melissa Hirsch fact-checked it. Our editorial director is A.M. Hall. And I'm your host, John Cullen Hill. This podcast is part of Vox, which doesn't have a paywall. Help us keep it that way by going to vox.com/give. I don't think you understand, like, how hard it was for me not to go get myself a little treat before this interview. Every day, I'm denying myself a little treat. I'm like, no, we're budgeting. We're healthy. But I want a little treat so bad every day.
But they told me if I get coffee every day, I'll never retire. So I know.
Well, hey. Well, it doesn't seem like Social Security is going to help with that. So I don't know. Get the croissants.
Oh, just you wait. I will write you of your error of your ways. And you will leave this interview and be like, Social Security is going to get me coffee for the rest of my life.
In U.S. working forests, or forest land carefully managed to provide a steady, renewable supply of wood for daily use, more than 1 billion trees are planted every year, and forestry experts protect and manage hundreds of millions of acres. Working forests have been sustainably managed for decades. How? It's simple. They plant more trees than they harvest. Learn more at workingforestsinitiative.com.